Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The robots are coming. Are you going to be automated out of a job? Well, that is a big and important question with the rise of the robot revolution. But we've been told that replacing humans with machines makes companies more efficient. It means more for less at the industry level. And in turn, the savings should be passed on to people. Everyone wins. So we've been told. But according to two economists at MIT and Boston University, the reality is not quite so rosy. Instead, despite increasing numbers of industrial robots and automation in the United States, productivity growth is at a historic low. And the people who've been losing their jobs to automation, they are not getting new ones. So where is that robot utopia we were promised? Joining us now is Evan Horowitz. He tackles the question, or this question, in his piece for the Boston Globe. It was titled, "Why Aren't Robots Boosting Economic Productivity?" And he joins us now in the studio. It's great to have you back, Evan.
It's great to be here and to be talking about something other than scandal in D.C.
Indeed. We're just talking about the end of work for humans instead. All right. So before we get to this question of the robot revolution and productivity, just let's start with a little bit of context here. I mean, how far along are we in terms of the second machine revolution, as it's been called by some folks at MIT, in terms of replacing human work?
Well, it's happening. The robots are coming. There's been about a five-fold increase in the number of these sort of reprogrammable industrial machines since about 1990. That's a big jump. It's still the early stages, but you'd expect to start seeing some of the effects, and the fact that we can't see positive effects is already, I think, a little troubling.
Okay, interesting. So in your piece, you reported, got some numbers here, that the use of, as you said, of industrial robots has grown by fivefold since the 90s, adding up to what, 1.75 robots for every 1,000 workers?
Exactly.
Okay. And so then to this question, I mean, it's supposed to be a pretty simple calculus, right? You spend the capital investment, then the robots essentially work for free, and they can work a lot more than human beings can, so productivity should go up.
Yeah, how could it not go up? I mean, you had 10 guys working in an assembly line putting cars together. Instead, you have one robot arm that puts the car together. Those 10 gentlemen who were on the assembly line can go somewhere else, find other jobs, do other things, and, you know, we should be able to make more stuff because the robot's making the cars. Those people can go make other things. Seems natural and inevitable. Just isn't happening.
It's not. So where's the proof that that's not happening?
Well, so the government keeps a very good track of productivity numbers. That is, how much stuff we make for every hour worked. And the reason we keep track of it is it's probably the most important economic indicator. I mean, there are two things behind economic growth. One is the population growing? And the other is productivity growing? And the only way to get richer is for productivity to grow. So we keep a careful eye on it, and it's growing at the slowest rate in 50 years.
The slowest rate in 50 years?
Yes.
Okay. Let's put some more shape on these numbers. You cite a new paper from a couple of MIT economists that say that, for example, a matching figure for that productivity loss is job losses.
So, yeah, it's an amazing paper. And they tracked where the robots are showing up and then looked to see what's happening to jobs in the places where the robots are showing up. And the answer is nothing good. Robots, every time a robot shows up in town, about 5 to 6 people lose their jobs. And that's a net loss. That doesn't mean they lose their jobs and go get other jobs. That means they drop out of employment. They have no employment after that. It's a pretty dramatic effect. I mean, for me, the really surprising thing about the paper is no productivity growth. I always thought, oh, well, then this robot thing's just not happening yet. It's just not possible. The robot thing can't be happening if there's no productivity. But then this paper comes out, and actually the robot thing is happening, and it's displacing people. So that should definitely mean productivity growth, but no.
Okay, so
right.
So I feel like, forgive me for just being, maybe I'm just a little slow today, but how is that possible?
This is, I think, the most interesting question. There are a bunch of theories, and I'll go through my favorite one first. But there are people who will still say, there must be something wrong with the paper. There are people who will say, like, this really can't be. It's an impossible puzzle. It's more like a paradox. The paper's got to be wrong, or we'd have productivity growth. But maybe not. Here's another alternative. And I borrow this from Ryan Event, who writes for The Economist. Imagine a robot showed up tomorrow that could do the work of 30% of all people in the country, mm-hmm. just one robot. Would that make us much, much more productive? Not really, because those people still need jobs. We don't have a very good social safety net. We don't have any system for them to survive without jobs. They would just fall into poverty. So what are they going to do? They're going to go get whatever jobs they can. And increasingly, available jobs are low productivity jobs. They're low wage jobs. And so there's a kind of offset. The robots are making some companies more productive, but the workers they're displacing are ending up in industries that have really, really low productivity, like, hey, can I go pick up your laundry for you and take it to your house? And the net effect is, no, people in general aren't better off.
Okay, so there, as you said, there's some pushback coming from different sectors about this assertion that robots aren't making the U.S. economy, at least, more productive. We have a little bit of tape here. This is David Otter. He's a professor of economics at MIT. And this is from a TED Talk that he gave in late 2016.
The fraction of U.S. adults employed in the labor market is higher now in 2016 than it was 125 years ago in 1890, and it's risen in just about every decade in the intervening 125 years.
Okay, so add to that Mark Andreessen. He said in 2016 that, quote, there are more net jobs in the world today than ever before, and hundreds of years of technological innovation and hundreds of years of people predicting the death of work. So the argument there is you take the long view. And, you know, maybe not today, but maybe 50 years today, we will see that productivity boost.
Yeah, that could very well happen. I will say before I get to answer that, one reason there are more net jobs is women can work. And that's less an economic story and more a sort of civil rights and women's rights story. But nevertheless, it is also true that up to now, every time there's been a big technological change, the economy has shifted in a way so that people did find things to do and ended up better off. Like, we could be in just the Luddite stage of the robot revolution, where hand loom weavers are very angry that there are now power looms in their factory, so they go and burn them down. And they weren't wrong. Like, the power looms were not good for those people. And yet, the industrialization of England is the most important economic event ever. Before it, poverty was the default human condition, and after it, poverty was not the default human condition. That may happen with robots. Maybe we're in the early stages. People are not seeing the benefits. But 50 years from now, affluence and limitless leisure time will be the default human condition. So far, though, that's just a story.
Okay, so but there's even a dark side to a future of affluence and unlimited leisure time. I mean, I was telling the staff earlier today that I remember those scenes in WALL-E, right? In the movie WALL-E, where humankind isn't doing so well because it has nothing to do. But on a more serious note, we have another bit of tape here. To your point, Evan, this is Nigel Cameron, president of the Center for Policy on Emerging Technologies, again from a TEDx talk. This is from 2014, and he talked about how the future could be, you know, one without work, thanks to robots. But then he added this thought:
is this a future which takes us to heaven on earth, in which we need not work? Or is it a future which takes us to hell on earth, in which we cannot work?
So, I mean, this, it sounds like a fantastical or crazed vision of the future. But if we're talking about, as you said, jobs aren't being transported or people aren't able to find equally satisfying or high paying work when they're displaced by robots, how does a society in which the future is one of many people unable to work going to function?
So I think this is sort of the biggest, most important long-term question of the robot revolution problem. That is, we've got to find a way for people to be happy. And work and the dignity of work has been a big part of human satisfaction for a very long time. And there isn't a good model. But it also seems like a pretty distant question for the moment. And there's a short-term version of it, which is, even before we get there, it would be nice to find things for today's robot displaced workers to be doing with their time other than, as I said, picking up someone's laundry or driving people around in an Uber. And there are ways to tackle this, and the two may be connected. That is, the short-term solution could be connected to the long-term solution with something like a guaranteed basic income.
Okay.
You could imagine starting with that now and building that out into the future.
Well, one could also imagine with every passing year or couple of years, there's new sectors in which the robots are entering. I mean, you mentioned ride-hailing drivers. Once the self-driving vehicle comes along, they're all out of work too.
Yeah.
I mean, so to that point, one more piece of tape here. There's been a lot of people thinking about our robot future. And I wanted to play this for you. This is James Besson, lecturer at the Boston University School of Law. And he's the author of Learning by Doing, The Real Connection Between Innovation, Wages, and Wealth. He gave a talk at Google, of all places, earlier this year.
I'm going to, in fact, argue that the idea of the end of work in the near future, the next 10 or 20 years, isn't really the main challenge. The main challenge is generating the skills to work with a new technology on a social scale. So it's scarce skills, not scarce jobs.
So Evan, I mean, on that point, in your research and talking to the economists that whose work underlies your article here, I mean, do you get a sense that they think we as a society are asking the right questions about how to deal with this future?
So I'll say two things. First, one of the really striking things about the paper we were talking about earlier, it's not just that low-skilled people lose their jobs when robots come to town. They couldn't find anybody who gained in terms of jobs or wages. So even people with postgraduate degrees, they weren't doing any better in the places where the robot's showing up. And that's surprising if you think the real challenge is we need to upskill and more people need to go to college. But college grads weren't doing very well either. So I don't know about that story. I also wanted to say, when I talked to people for this piece from from robotics trade groups, you know, you call people who sell these things or who manage consortiums of organizations who sell these things, and you ask them, like, hey, do you think you're ever going to be replaced by a robot?
Oh, dear.
Right? And they laugh it off like it's an absurd kind of question, but I don't think it is. Artificial intelligence is getting better. Robots are getting smarter. There will come for doctors' jobs and reporters' jobs. And, I mean, our conversation could easily be automated. You know, there's the old Simpsons joke where they just turn – I think it's a Simpsons joke. And the Autobot says, ooh, those boobs in Congress, ha, ha, ha. Right?
Yeah.
You can imagine such a thing a bit smarter than that. So I think in some ways it isn't just an upskilling problem, and it's not just a future problem. It is a problem of finding productive things for all people to do, and it's a problem that's starting now if the robots have already come and they're putting people out of work and forcing them into low-paying jobs.
I mean, it's a real and I think pressing challenge for all of us in the future, but at least I'm glad to say that right now both you and I had a human conversation. Evan Horowitz, he writes the Quick Study column for the Boston Globe that looks at data and policy issues in Massachusetts. His article about the robot revolution and productivity in the U.S. economy was in the Globe. We have a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. Evan, thank you so very much.
It was great. Thank you, Meghna.
Time now for the Remembrance Project, our weekly look at the extraordinary lives of ordinary people in our community. This morning, today, writer Alyssa Eli remembers a Brookline bookstore owner who was a true individualist.
Growing up in Sao Paulo, Brazil, Susana Michelle's Portuguese nickname translated to Little No. It could also have translated to Little Rebellion. In Catholic school, she used to confess to elaborate sins, but the confessions were strictly for her own amusement, since the sins were non-existent. Also, Susana was Jewish. When her beloved older sister moved to Israel for college, Little No decided she needed to move to Israel, too. She maneuvered an expulsion from not one but two schools in Sao Paulo, and her exasperated parents finally sent her to a kibbutz for troubled youth. The vitality and rawness of that emerging country, Israel's own rebelliousness, spoke to her. Susanna thrived on joyful camaraderie. It was asking for trouble, of course, when she joined the army. Spirited backtalk led to many desert marches with extra weighted packs. But she made it clear to her daughter, Natalie Kingsbury, that this was a price, like others in her life, she willingly paid.
She used to say, she goes, it's so much better, you really should be like this. She goes, you're like a volcano, you explode, and then it's done. She literally advised me to be like a volcano because it was better. It was healthier.
The fearless non-traditionalist entered a more traditional chapter when she married an American military man. They moved around the country, Maryland, the Pacific Northwest, where she tried selling Avon cosmetics to other Army wives, but her accent was too thick for commerce. When Natalie was in sixth grade, Susanna followed another dream. She enrolled in college, eventually left the marriage, moved on to graduate school, and became a teacher. She fed and clothed immigrant students and relished a role as their sounding board. She had once been an immigrant herself. After Natalie moved to Boston, Susanna moved there too and opened a foreign language bookstore, Mundy International, in Coolidge Corner. She was fluent in seven languages, teaching her daughter to swear in all of them, and the vision of a gathering place for multilingual community compelled her. But sometimes her independence interfered.
I don't always think that she was great in customer service. My mom was one of those people that you either loved or you didn't love. You know, if she wanted to close for the day, she would just flip the sign and say, I'm going home. And I'm like, Mom, you can't, it's a business. And she's like, well, I'm the owner and I'm done for the day.
Living with certainty and, when necessary, with dissent, never abandoned her. After Susanna was diagnosed with early dementia, she spoke French to the Haitian nurses and Spanish to the Latino nurses in the nursing home.
The last time I saw her, she said to me, Natalie, go! And then she went and laid in bed and turned around and said, I'm done talking to people now.
She was as good as her word and died several days later.
Susanna Michel died in Brookline in December. She was 70 years old. To suggest someone for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be back. This is Radio Boston.